Chapter 135. Nicholas despairs of rescuing Madeleine Bray, but plucks up his spirits again, and determines to attempt it. Domestic intelligence of the Kenwickses and Lillivicks, finding that Newman was determined to arrest his progress at any hazard, and apprehensive that some well-intentioned passenger, attracted by the cry of "Stop thief!" apostrophe might lay violent hands upon his person, and place him in a disagreeable predicament from which he might have some difficulty in extricating himself, Nicholas soon slackened his pace, and suffered Newman Knox to come up with him, which he did, in so breathless a condition, that it seemed impossible he could have held out for a minute longer. "I will go straight to Bray's," apostrophe said Nicholas. "I will see this man. If there is a feeling of humanity lingering in his breast, a spark of consideration for his own child, motherless and friendless as she is, I will awaken it." Apostrophe, "You will not," apostrophe replied Newman. "You will not, indeed." Apostrophe, "Then," apostrophe said Nicholas, pressing onward, "I will act upon my first impulse, and go straight to Ralph Nickleby." Apostrophe, "By the time you reach his house he will be in bed," apostrophe said Newman. "I'll drag him from it," apostrophe cried Nicholas. "Tut, tut," apostrophe said Knox. "Be yourself." Apostrophe, "You are the best of friends to me, Newman," apostrophe rejoined Nicholas after a pause, and taking his hand as he spoke. "I have made head against many trials, but the misery of another, and such misery, is involved in this one, that I declare to you, I am rendered desperate, and know not how to act." Apostrophe, "In truth, it did seem a hopeless case. It was impossible to make any use of such intelligence as Newman Knox had gleaned, when he lay concealed in the closet. The mere circumstance of the compact between Ralph Nickleby and Gride would not invalidate the marriage, or render Bray averse to it, who, if he did not actually know of the existence of some such understanding, doubtless suspected it. What had been hinted with reference to some fraud on Madeleine, had been put, with sufficient obscurity by Arthur Gride, but coming from Newman Knox, and obscured still further by the smoke of his pocket pistol, it became wholly unintelligible, and involved in utter darkness. "There seems no ray of hope," apostrophe said Nicholas. "The greater necessity for coolness, for reason, for consideration, for thought," apostrophe said Newman, pausing at every alternate word, to look anxiously in his friend's face. "Where are the brothers?" Apostrophe, "Both absent on urgent business, as they will be for a week to come." Apostrophe, "Is there no way of communicating with them? No way of getting one of them here by tomorrow night?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Impossible." Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Nicholas, "The sea is between us and them. With the fairest winds that ever blew, to go and return would take 3 days and nights." Apostrophe, "Their nephew," apostrophe said Newman, "their old clerk." Apostrophe, "What could either do, that I cannot?" Apostrophe, apostrophe rejoined Nicholas. "With reference to them, especially, I am enjoined to the strictest silence on this subject. What right have I to betray the confidence reposed in me, when nothing but a miracle can prevent this sacrifice?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Think," apostrophe urged Newman. "Is there no way?" Apostrophe, "There is none," apostrophe said Nicholas, in utter dejection. "Not one. The father urges, the daughter consents. These demons have her in their toils. Legal right, might, power, money, and every influence are on their side. How can I hope to save her?" Apostrophe, "Hope to the last." Apostrophe, apostrophe said Newman, clapping him on the back. "Always hope, that's a dear boy. Never leave off hoping, it don't answer. Do you mind me, Nick? It don't answer. Don't leave a stone unturned. It's always something, to know you've done the most you could. But, don't leave off hoping, or it's of no use doing anything. Hope, hope, to the last." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Nicholas needed encouragement. the suddenness with which intelligence of the two usurers' plans had come upon him, the little time which remained for exertion, the probability, almost amounting to certainty itself, that a few hours would place Madeline Bray forever beyond his reach, consign her to unspeakable misery, and perhaps to an untimely death. All this quite stunned and overwhelmed him. Every hope connected with her, that he had suffered himself to form, or had entertained unconsciously, seemed to fall at his feet, withered and dead. Every charm with which his memory or imagination had surrounded her, presented itself before him, only to heighten his anguish, and add new bitterness to his despair. Every feeling of sympathy for her forlorn condition, and of admiration for her heroism and fortitude, aggravated the indignation which shook him in every limb, and swelled his heart almost to bursting. But, if Nicholas's own heart embarrassed him, Newman's came to his relief. There was so much earnestness in his remonstrance, and such sincerity and fervor in his manner, odd and ludicrous as it always was, that it imparted to Nicholas new firmness, and enabled him to say, after he had walked on for some little way in silence, "You read me a good lesson, Newman, and I will profit by it. One step, at least, I may take, am bound to take indeed, and to that I will apply myself tomorrow." "Apostrophe, what is that?"
"Apostrophe, apostrophe," asked Knox wistfully.
"Not to threaten Ralph? Not to see the father?"
"Apostrophe, apostrophe, to see the daughter, Newman, apostrophe," replied Nicholas.
"To do what, after all, is the utmost that the brothers could do, if they were here, as heaven send they were. To reason with her upon this hideous union, to point out to her all the horrors to which she is hastening, rashly, it may be, and without due reflection. To entreat her, at least, to pause. She can have had no counselor for her good. Perhaps even I may move her so far yet, though it is the 11th hour, and she upon the very brink of ruin."
"Apostrophe, bravely spoken.
Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Newman.
"Well done, well done.
Yes.
Very good.
Apostrophe, and I do declare, apostrophe," cried Nicholas, with honest enthusiasm, "that in this effort I am influenced by no selfish or personal considerations, but by pity for her, and detestation and abhorrence of this scheme, and that I would do the same, were there 20 rivals in the field, and I the last and least favored of them all."
"Apostrophe, you would, I believe, apostrophe," said Newman.
"But where are you hurrying now?"
"Apostrophe, apostrophe, homewards, apostrophe," answered Nicholas.
"Do you come with me, or I shall say good night."
"Apostrophe, apostrophe, I'll come a little way, if you will but walk."
"Not run, apostrophe," said Knox.
"I cannot walk tonight, Newman, apostrophe," returned Nicholas, hurriedly.
"I must move rapidly, or I could not draw my breath. I'll tell you what I've said and done tomorrow."
Apostrophe, without waiting for a reply, he darted off at a rapid pace, and, plunging into the crowds which thronged the street, was quickly lost to view.
"He's a violent youth at times, apostrophe," said Newman, looking after him, "and yet like him for it. There's cause enough now, or the deuce is in it."
"Hope."
"I said hope, I think." Ralph Nickleby and Gride with their heads together.
"And hope for the opposite party.
Ho, ho."
Apostrophe, it was with a very melancholy laugh that Newman Knox concluded this soliloquy, and it was with a very melancholy shake of the head, and a very rueful countenance, that he turned about, and went plodding on his way.
This, under ordinary circumstances, would have been to some small tavern or dram shop, that being his way, in more senses than one. But, Newman was too much interested, and too anxious, to betake himself even to this resource, and so, with many desponding and dismal reflections, went straight home. It had come to pass, that afternoon, that Miss Morlina Kenwicks had received an invitation to repair next day, her steamer from Westminster Bridge, unto the Eel Pie Island at Twickenham, there to make merry upon a cold collation, bottled beer, shrub, and shrimps,
and to dance in the open air to the music of a locomotive band, conveyed thither for the purpose. The steamer being specially engaged by a dancing master of extensive connection for the accommodation of his numerous pupils, and the pupils displaying their appreciation of the dancing master's services, by purchasing themselves, and inducing their friends to do the like, divers light blue tickets, entitling them to join the expedition. Of these light blue tickets, one had been presented by an ambitious neighbor to Miss Marlena Kenwicks, with an invitation to join her daughters, and Mrs. Kenwicks, rightly deeming that the honor of the family was involved in Miss Marlena's making the most splendid appearance possible on so short a notice, and testifying to the dancing master that there were other dancing masters besides him, and to all fathers and mothers present that other people's children could learn to be genteel besides theirs, had fainted away twice under the magnitude of her preparations, but, upheld by a determination to sustain the family name or perish in the attempt, was still hard at work when Newman Knox came home. Now, between the Italian ironing of frills, the flouncing of trousers, the trimming of frocks, the faintings and the comings to again, incidental to the occasion, Mrs. Kenwicks had been so entirely occupied that she had not observed, until within half an hour before, that the flaxen tails of Miss Marlena's hair were, in a manner, run to seed, and that, unless she were put under the hands of a skillful hairdresser, she never could achieve that signal triumph over the daughters of all other people, anything less than which would be tantamount to defeat. This discovery drove Mrs. Kenwicks to despair, for the hairdresser lived three streets and eight dangerous crossings off. Marlena could not be trusted to go there alone, even if such a proceeding were strictly proper, of which Mrs. Kenwicks had her doubts. Mr. Kenwicks had not returned from business, and there was nobody to take her. So, Mrs. Kenwicks first slapped Miss Kenwicks for being the cause of her vexation, and then shed tears. "You ungrateful child!" said Mrs. Kenwicks, "after I have gone through what I have, this night, for your good." "I can't help it, ma," replied Marlena, also in tears. "My hair will grow." "Don't talk to me, you naughty thing." said Mrs. Kenwicks, "don't. Even if I was to trust you by yourself and you were to escape being run over, I know you'd run into Laura Chopkins, who was the daughter of the ambitious neighbor, and tell her what you're going to wear tomorrow. I know you would. You've no proper pride in yourself, and are not to be trusted out of sight for an instant." Deploring the evil-mindedness of her eldest daughter in these terms, Mrs. Kenwicks distilled fresh drops of vexation from her eyes, and declared that she did believe there never was anybody so tried as she was. Thereupon, Marlena Kenwicks wept afresh, and they bemoaned themselves together. Matters were at this point, as Newman Knox was heard to limp past the door on his way upstairs, when Mrs. Kenwicks, gaining new hope from the sound of his footsteps, hastily removed from her countenance as many traces of her late emotion as were effaceable on so short a notice, and presenting herself before him, and representing their dilemma, entreated that he would escort Marlena to the hairdresser's shop. "I wouldn't ask you, Mr. Knox," said Mrs. Kenwicks, "if I didn't know what a good, kind-hearted creature you are. No, not for worlds. I am a weak constitution, Mr. Knox, but my spirit would no more let me ask a favor where I thought there was a chance of its being refused than it would let me submit to see my children trampled down and trod upon by envy and lowness." Newman was too good-natured not to have consented, even without this avowal of confidence on the part of Mrs. Kenwicks. Accordingly, a very few minutes had elapsed when he and Miss Marlena were on their way to the hairdresser's. It was not exactly a hairdresser's. That is to say, people of a coarse and vulgar turn of mind might have called it a barber's, for they not only cut and curled ladies elegantly and children carefully, but shaved gentlemen easily. Still, it was a highly genteel establishment, quite first-rate in fact, and there were displayed in the window, besides other elegancies, waxen busts of a light lady, and a dark gentleman which were the admiration of the whole neighborhood. Indeed, some ladies had gone so far as to assert that the dark gentleman was actually a portrait of the spurted young proprietor, and the great similarity between their headdresses both wore very glossy hair, with a narrow walk straight down the middle, and a profusion of flat circular curls on both sides encouraged the idea. The better informed among the sex, however, made light of this assertion, for however willing they were, and they were very willing, to do full justice to the handsome face and figure of the proprietor, they held the countenance of the dark gentleman in the window to be an exquisite and abstract idea of masculine beauty, realized sometimes, perhaps, among angels and military men, but very rarely embodied to gladden the eyes of mortals. It was to this establishment that Newman Knox led Miss Kenwicks in safety. The proprietor, knowing that Miss Kenwicks had three sisters, each with two flaxen tails, and all good for sixpence apiece, once a month at least, promptly deserted an old gentleman whom he had just lathered for shaving, and handing him over to the journeyman, who was not very popular among the ladies, by reason of his obesity and middle age, waited on the young lady himself. Just as this change had been effected, there presented himself for shaving, a big, burly, good-humored coal heaver with a pipe in his mouth, who, drawing his hand across his chin, requested to know when the shaver would be disengaged. The journeyman, to whom this question was put, looked doubtfully at the young proprietor, and the young proprietor looked scornfully at the coal heaver, observing at the same time, "You won't get shaved here, my man." "Why not?" said the coal heaver. "We don't shave gentlemen in your line," remarked the young proprietor. "Why, I see you a shaving of a baker, when I was a looking through the winder, last week," said the coal heaver. "It's necessary to draw the line somewheres, my fine feller," replied the principal. "We draw the line there. We can't go beyond bakers. If we was to get any lower than bakers, our customers would desert us, and we might shut up shop. You must try some other establishment, sir. We couldn't do it here." The applicant stared, grinned at Newman Knox, who appeared highly entertained, looked slightly round the shop, as if in depreciation of the pomatum pots and other articles of stock, took his pipe out of his mouth, and gave a very loud whistle, and then put it in again. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.